Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before I get into our great guest of the week, I want to always remind people to go to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. And I've got a number of podcasts. I've got over 175 now. It's amazing. And of course, please go in to iTunes and rate and review, because it helps elevate the exposure of this wonderful podcast. We've got so many amazing people doing incredible things, and everybody should hear about what is going on to help elevate their place in life. I'm also headed out to Mount Everest. This is something that's been ongoing now. The new due date is March 31st, 2021. I'm so jacked up. Today we're sitting here in the beginning of October. The leaves are changing. It's amazing here in Sun Valley. And I continue to train like anybody who puts out a big goal and wants to go after it. If you want to find out about that, of course, please go to my blog on the website, and you can find out all about it. I also have another app from Garmin that will allow you to follow me up and down the mountain, which is actually a pretty cool feature that they have, and also allow me to communicate back, which is I'm really excited about. So, and finally, my daughter, who's got epilepsy, we're doing another campaign partnering up with Higher Ground called Amelia's Everest, the Lhotse Challenge. And we're trying to raise $27,940. We're already underway, so that's a really cool thing. And you can also find that tab on my website. Again, www.markpattisonnfl.com. It's all there. Okay, let's get into today's guest. I'm so stoked. It's another referral from our friends over at Higher Ground. We will get into that and the organization in just a bit. But his name is Derek Abbey. Derek, how you doing?
I'm doing wonderful, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a beautiful day here in Sun Valley. I couldn't imagine a better place to be in.
Oh, man, it's just, it's the where, I mean, look, I mean, there's many, many, many wonderful places all over the world, and you live in Bend, Oregon. Yep. You've traveled down here to get away from some of the fires, but boy, I mean, it's just like I like pinch myself every day when I go out and I've got these yellows and these reds and these oranges on all these aspen trees, and I just want to go and hug it, and you know, and it really brings me to life. And with so much going on right now, again today, we're early in October here, and we're talking about Black Lives Matter, and we've got COVID, and we've got fires across the West, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, somehow or another, people just got to take that time out and just, like, truly, you know, smell the roses.
Yeah, literally turn the TV off. If you can, go outside, spend some time in the outdoors, and get the most out of it. It's a nice reset, and you need it more than ever today with all these media inputs from every single angle, and you know, none of them seem to be positive nowadays. So I like to go out and get in the outdoors and enjoy the outside, and
it's awesome,
perfect,
isn't it?
Reset for me.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Well, talk about a reset. So I want to reset to your life, because it, to me, you know, when I was doing the research, and it was really incredible. Both you and I are from Seattle. And I grew up kind of right in the middle of the city, and it sounds like you bounced around a lot. And, you know, the name of this podcast, of course, is Finding Your Summit, about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And, you know, what really jumped out to me was, you know, you had this tragic loss. You know, number one, your mom and dad divorced early, and then you're 13 years old and your mom passes away.
Yeah.
Like, how do you deal with that?
As a 13-year-old, you don't usually deal with it very well. You don't have the tools for it. There's no real book that you can read or anything like that, especially back then. And it was completely unexpected. So my mom was there, healthy one day, and then had a brain aneurysm and was gone the following day. So, you know, my life was turned upside down. I was 13. I completely lost my rudder and sail, didn't really know what direction I was going to go in, ended up going and living with my aunt and uncle after that.
And before you go after that, mm-hmm. your aunt and uncle, that experience was good or was it bad?
It was about as good as you could expect. You know, I went through a tragedy as a young boy, and they had their own lives. They weren't expecting to have, you know, another addition to their family suddenly. And they did that as best as they could to work with this young person as he was trying to figure his way through high school and life and what was going to be next. But, you know, it was about what you would expect is what I would explain it.
Well, you know, so you say that, and I don't even know how that would go, mm-hmm. right? That's not my situation. And I mean, I'm sure what to expect. You know, I mean, some people step up and are wonderful and amazing and really change people's lives. I've got some friends in Seattle where it's a long story, but they ended up basically with this baby on the front step, and the baby came from a, you know, meth head, drug induced, everything else, everything awful about the course that this little kid would have gone down. And my friends in Seattle, the Wagners, are well off, and they're the best family and the best people of all time. And they've literally changed this kid. Mm-hmm. And now this kid will go to private universities and schools and all the trips, and they're going to get all the goodies. And it's just because she happened to be dealt that lucky card. Now, in all this, and I don't want to spend much time on this because I want to get into kind of what really matters, and that's mm-hmm. the military. But was your dad just not existent?
Yeah, he just wasn't. He wasn't present. My mom and dad, they divorced when they were young. My mom didn't graduate high school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she did as well as she could to try and raise this rambunctious little boy by herself and bounce around from job to job and place to place. And then, like we mentioned earlier, unfortunately she passed when I was 13. And so my direction was not really established before she died. And then when she died, you know, it was just off the rails. I had no idea what I was going to do. Yeah. And that lasted through the rest of my youth, really. I mean, there were things that I had aspirations of doing and never really got to do. I was a wrestler. I wanted to play football and things mm-hmm. like that, but those never really came to fruition. And so I got a job when I was 16 at Dairy Queen, and that kind of filled the time. And I made my way through high school, and looking into the future, it was just a big unknown. Like, what I like to say is I was really just adrift looking for a direction. I didn't have a rudder. I didn't have a sail. And that's actually how I ended up in the Marine Corps. I never really had aspirations of joining the military, although when I was young, I kind of looked up to men that had served in the military, and they were these role models to me in some ways, and most of the ways they were fantasies because they weren't real people to me. But I ran away to the Marine Corps. Honestly, I needed a place to go. But
what was that about the Marine? You know, like, you're there, you're going through all this, and you're having a tough time. You're working at Dairy Queen, and you're trying to have these aspirations, and why me and this and that and everything else, and you're adrift. You know, there's no rudder as you described, and all of a sudden you push the button hyperspace, right, and off you go, right. And of all the things you could do, you could run off to Europe, you could join some, you know, crazy clan, you could do, but you end up joining the Marines. So tell me why, like, what was there something? Did you see an officer and the gentleman? I mean, what was it that?
Well, I was looking at the military because it was an escape. It was something to get me out of where I was. And I looked to the military and I saw the Marine Corps, and honestly, like so many young people, they had the best uniforms, and it seemed like the hardest.
Yeah.
It seemed like the
biggest
challenge,
man. Yeah.
And so found myself in the recruiter's office, and that was an easy sell. And, you know, not too long after that, I was in boot camp. And there was another thing that was going on when I signed up. It was Saddam Hussein had crossed the border into Kuwait, and we were, you know, dealing with him with Desert Storm and Desert Shield. So he invaded on August 2nd. And on August 30th was when I signed the paper. So that was kind of this extra motivation, a way to prove myself, a way to go on and play my part, do something of value, really. And so I kind of scanned the services, and the Marine Corps looked like the place to be. Of course, by the time I ended up in boot camp and through all the schools, the war was over and everything, and I missed that opportunity. But those opportunities would definitely show themselves later.
So I know that you went into, because what you're doing today is really the cool part of this whole story, right? Yeah. And we're going to get to that in a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But you had three deployments to Iraq and a couple, one or two, maybe more, to Afghanistan, right?
One to Afghanistan.
One to Afghanistan. Okay. So now you go in and walk through the path of two things. Of number one, of the preparation that they put you through to put you in a place where you could go over to Afghanistan, but first Iraq, and be effective.
Yeah.
And then the follow-up question to that is, like, what, I mean, you were doing some hardcore stuff, and I want to, like, get into, like, what, you know, like, what was that, right, that really was defining for you?
Yeah, so the first piece was, you know, I'm this 18-year-old without a rudder or sail, and the Marine Corps, or the military itself, was a system of structure and a system that I could succeed in was exactly what I needed at that point. And so the Marine Corps very, very quickly established confidence in me through boot camp and the schools and becoming a Marine and pinning on that Eagle, Globe, and Anchor and really realizing, like, oh, I can have an impact on something now, and I can do this, and I can do it pretty well. You know, the system isn't that difficult. They tell you how to succeed in it, and so if you do what they say, if you do it a little bit faster, a little bit better, you're probably going to do really, really well. And I did. I was a successful young Marine, and I invested in the Marine Corps. I truly gave my heart and soul to it, and in turn, they invested in me. So I got an education, ended up getting a commission, and then was commissioned a ground officer, actually. And then all Marines have to go through the six-month school called the basic school, where you learn basic infantry tactics and company level officer stuff. And while I was there, I was selected for flight school and ended up getting sent to flight school and became a Marine aviator. I was a weapons systems officer in the F-18. So successful through flight school, joined my first squadron. And while I was in flight school was when 9/11 happened. And so Afghanistan kicked off. And by the time I was finishing flight school, it was very obvious we were going to be going to Iraq next.
So you're actually flying these planes?
Yeah, I'm a backseater. So Wizzo in the F-18, two-seat version of the F-18.
So what's the guy in the backseat do? Is that Goose?
Yep, Goose. Okay. There. That's what most people recognize as Goose from Top Gun. Yeah. My call sign was Cosmo.
But, Cosmo. All right. Cool.
That's a whole other story. Yeah. Entertaining, but fun.
And so
I had a successful first part of my career. You know, I was advanced pretty quickly, obviously went from the enlisted ranks to the officer side of things. So they saw something in me, and compared to where I was when I was 18, you know, my confidence grew and grew and grew. My capabilities grew and grew and grew. And it was recognized, and that brought with it more responsibility and more opportunities. And, you know, so after I finished flight school, I joined my first squadron and very, very quickly found myself overhead Iraq. And it was actually, I was doing Southern Watch, if you remember Operation Southern Watch, before the war kicked off. We used to have a no-fly zone, so yeah, I was flying those missions.
Yeah, I mean, literally anybody up, they were going down, right?
Yeah, and so we were flying those missions, and I was actually overhead Iraq when OAF kicked off. And so then we did the whole push
which
north.
Which is the Operation Freedom.
Iraqi Freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah, the invasion into Iraq, so... got to see what it's like when our U.S. military takes the leash off of the dogs and lets them go. It's an incredible thing to witness as they moved north through Iraq and all the way through the country. So got to support that and do some things that people haven't done in a long time or never have done. And then I went back and did it a few more times. I was there for the Fallujah piece when...
crazy place to be.
Yeah, and... I that was an aviation tour for me, so we were doing danger close air support on a day-to-day basis in an urban environment, which, you know, we were basically writing the doctrine for urban close air support in real time while we were doing it and helping those Marines and soldiers and others on the ground as they move their way through that town. And then did another tour, which was a little bit more quiet. My third tour to Iraq was more quiet, and then I was done in the F-18 and went on to some other interesting things. So I actually left the Hornet community and became a plank holder or original member of Marine Special Operations Command. So
what does that mean, plank holder?
It's an original member. So when they establish a unit, the very first people in that unit are considered plank holders. And it comes from nautical tradition, the Navy tradition of the Marine Corps, the planks of the ship. So when you're the first crew of the ship.
I got it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was part of the 1st Battalion, what's now 1st Raider Battalion. It was 1st Marine Special Operations Battalion when we started it, and the 1st Delta Company over there. I started as the battalion air officer while we were building out the battalion, and then when we started Delta Company, I became the air officer for Delta Company and ultimately the XO of Delta Company and deployed to Afghanistan.
So what was what was the goal that you guys were trying to accomplish?
So up until that point, all the other services had their special operations branch, and the Marine Corps has always had recon, force reconnaissance, and they're often doing the mission of special operations, but they weren't necessarily paid the same way, so they didn't fall under SOCOM. But they were doing some pretty impressive stuff. But then when the Marine Corps created the Special Operations Arm, now they were an element of Special Operations Command as well as being Marines. And so that came with a whole another line of funding, a build out of the mission. Now they've built out their own schoolhouse. So the Army has the Green Berets, Navy has the SEALs, yep. Air Force has their PJs and combat controllers. And now the Marine Corps has the Raiders as their operators. And so I was lucky enough to spent some time in a ready room of a fighter squadron and a team room of a special operations company. And
yeah, wow.
So a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Well, so, I mean, this is kind of like a separate question here, but
yeah.
what is, for people like myself, right, mm-hmm. civilians who have never been to the Middle East, right, mm-hmm. what is Iraq like in comparison to Afghanistan?
Well, I guess the first thing you would note is Afghanistan is far more mountainous. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are mountains in parts of Iraq, but most of the time where I was
it's
working...
It's the big desert, right?
Yeah, yeah, and they're both deserts. But when I think about my time in Iraq, living there for a couple of deployments, flat desert environment, although it gets very, very cold in the winter, and that wind will blast across the desert, nothing stops it. So when it hits you, it feels like it's kind of cutting through you. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then Afghanistan, as far as environment goes, at least where we were, more mountainous. So we would spend some time out the mountains doing missions, more hills and stuff like that. There's also, there's green areas in both countries, but they're both part of the Middle East. So there's similarities too.
Yeah. Well, I watched this movie the other night called Outpost, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's just they set up this camp way up high up in the mountains, and it was at the base of this valley. And so it just, these guys were just launching grenades and bombs
yeah.
and gunfire right down on their... And it's like, who had the brains to put that together?
Yeah, they had the high ground. I know exactly what you're talking about. And yeah, there definitely weren't any situations like that in Iraq. Pretty much flat terrain, no outposts sitting in the valley or anything like
yeah.
that with the enemy having hard high ground or something.
Yeah,
like that.
You're just a sitting duck is yeah. the bottom line. Okay, so one of the things that... you've been very fortunate as a beneficiary of being in the military is having this amazing educational, yeah. I wouldn't say it's the system, but just the background of the military yeah. essentially funding your way through. So Oregon State and then down to you get your undergrad and then down to University of San Diego, which is a sweet city and a sweet school.
Yeah.
You get your master's, and you recently finished your PhD in leadership.
Yep, yeah, at the University of San Diego. Too.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, incredible place, but what was it about leadership? I mean, here you go. Let's go back to, when you're a young guy up in Seattle yeah. and you're just this rudderless ship going down, not knowing which way is up and down, and, what's my life going to be about? You're just a Joe employee at the DQ,
yeah.
Dairy Queen, right?
I can make a mean ice cream cone.
Yeah, well, listen, I
think I still could.
Yeah. Just vanilla whip or chocolate, right? And yeah, but anyways, so you've really focused a lot of what you have been able to do in this word leadership. And I was so fortunate to be around some of the amazing leaders, not only as coaches in my college and in the NFL, but also around these amazing players that, held these qualities. But for you, what was that driving force? Like this is, obviously there's something to that because of your desire to really go to the top.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how many PhDs you can get or go beyond that, but you really have become an expert in this particular field.
Yeah, there's multiple elements to that. So, I mentioned earlier, my mom didn't finish high yeah. school. And so as I was growing up, education represented success to me in so many ways. Like if I can attain these degrees, I'm moving towards something that's positive and successful. And then so that I sought that out, and I've always been fascinated by it. The more that I learned and the more I participated in education, the more passion that I had about it. I was very interested in teaching when I was younger, and that drove me towards more education, and that shifted as I went through it. The other piece of it is, you know, when you think about young Derek working at DQ and taking off to the Marine Corps, my sphere of influence at that point was one, me, you know, and so at some point along the way, and now I'm very, very conscious of it, my personal mission turned into, I want to have a positive impact on as many people as possible throughout my life. And through the Marine Corps and my experiences throughout my adult life, my sphere of influence grew from me as an individual to people around the world that I'm able to have an impact on through my service in the military. So all these military members that I worked with and supported, whether it was on the ground or in the air, people in my squadron that I worked with directly, people in the units that I worked with directly, to, you know, these people that were supporting. And, you know, I'm happy to say there's people that came home from those conflicts because of the work that we did. Mm-hmm. And that just, that's incredibly fulfilling. And so when I started my master's, I studied history in my undergrad, and that was fascinating, just the human experience. And so much about history is just learning that, the human experience, mm-hmm. And realizing that humans tend to be the same throughout time. We see things that we're seeing today, and we may think that they're unique, but they've happened time and time again because it's part of the human experience. And then I was exposed to leadership practice in the Marine Corps, definitely, and both good and bad. And so my outlook on that was, I would look at what people were doing and try and mimic the positive things that they were doing. And then I would look at people that were doing it in a way that I thought wasn't that great and note the things that I thought weren't great and make sure I kept them out of my toolbox. And then when I first started my master's and was exposed to kind of the theoretical side and more than just traits and character-based leadership, but how are you influencing people to move in a direction, hopefully in mass, to have a positive impact on the greater community, and where does your voice have power, and how does that work within these groups? I just became more and more fascinated with the theoretical foundation of it, but then the practical application of it. And so I just wanted to learn more and more and more about it. And so, you know, I went about as far as you could with the PhD.
Yeah. Well, you know, before we went live here, we were talking about the commonality between the military and the NFL community. Mm-hmm. I would even drop that down to many college players too. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of those guys that I played with had aspirations to play in the NFL. And then when you put so much of that time in, even though you have a college education, there's just this gap, right? Mm-hmm. And now the NFL has done a fantastic job over the years. Certainly when I was playing, you just went off the cliff. And for a lot of these military guys, I know you've really put a hand in that in terms of just really trying to help them, encourage, and from the leadership standpoint of knowledge is power, and power mm-hmm. is connection, and connection can lead to some great things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're the best example of your story of going from Dairy Queen to joining the Marines, and, you know, where that has taken you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the more that people can get connected in and you start to gain confidence, you start to gain relationships with other people, and then that can lead to something that I say all the time is action creates reaction,
mm-hmm.
right? And the worst thing that can happen, and, you know, the example I was talking about earlier where I was working out with Nate Boyer, and they're, what he's trying to do between, you know, the military and help those guys, you know, really come across the bridge to the other side, which is just try to help educate and listen. And it's like, but, you know, when you're in these amazing environments, there's this brotherhood, mm-hmm. sisterhood that you have, the locker room for us.
Yeah.
And then we both break, right? You're done with Afghanistan. I'm done in the NFL. And then now I'm just back in my apartment or wherever you're at, yeah. alone, right?
Yeah.
And just really trying to, like, help. And I know you've been really instrumental in that.
Yeah, and that, well, as I was studying leadership, and, you know, when you work on a doctorate, you have to create a dissertation, create new knowledge. And I examined, where does my voice have weight? Where do I have access? What populations can I have an influence on? And the military was one of them. So I looked at the military and the higher education environment and accessing that environment. But I also looked at the transition of military and what were some of the things that were causing friction within that transition. position, because when I initially looked at it, it really didn't make any sense to me. And if you look at, you could look at it from the military lens, but you can also look at it professional athlete, NFL lens, your own experiences. And then the reason it didn't make much sense to me is because when you're in the military, you're in constant transition. You're executing orders. You just executed orders. You're going to the field. You're going on deployment, coming back from deployment, all these different things. And then we as a general society are not really stagnant like we were maybe in the past. You know, we both grew up in and around Seattle. Neither one of us is there anymore. We're in different places, right. And we've moved multiple times since then. So I really took a step back and wanted to examine what was the thing that was causing all this friction for military members when they're separating. And it turns out, for the most part, beyond, you know, injuries and things like that, both mental and physical injuries, it's these intangible pieces. So it's that perceived loss of identity, and exploring what other identities you hold, having those intimate relationships that you gain and maintain through shared experience, shared hardship, all those things going on a deployment, depending on others. Same thing in growing up as an athlete.
Yeah, I can relate
your life to it. Yeah.
And then you're saying I relate to it.
Yeah. And then you step out of that system and now you have to find what that new legacy is going to be. What's that new impact or what's your new purpose? We throw around the purpose word a little bit too loosely, I think. But how are you going to have an impact now for the rest of your life or in this new phase? Yeah. And the scary thing about it is you have all the efficacy to pick what it is that you want to have an impact on. And that's really, really scary because you might screw it up and trip over yourself or you're a little, you know, you just don't know what you want to have an impact on. And too often I see people say, you know, they just want to have this massive impact and then they fall short and then they kind of spiral out of control. But it's just, it could be, you know, your kid's kickball team and coaching that and having an influence on them or whatever your sphere is, examining where your voice carries weight and then putting energy into that and then building relationships with people that might not have had an experience in the NFL or in the military and what are expectations that you should have of them and what are realistic expectations that they can have of you. And then, you know, who am I besides Derek the Marine, you know, and developing those identities and holding on to them. And nobody's ever going to take away my military experience or that I'm a veteran or anything like that. But I'm also all these other things. And, you know, when you kind of expose that to people, when they're finding themselves in these kind of moments of friction, then it's kind of, the light bulb goes off many times. It's like, oh yeah, I can do this. And yeah, I might screw it up a little bit from time to time. And that's okay, because that's when we're going to learn. What I like to tell the people that I work with is, we are going to fail, but we're going to fail fast and cheap, and we're going to learn from it, and then we're going to move on.
It's the key.
And it's where innovation is, right? And you have innovation in your own development, and that whole control of it, you control your destiny now. We all start in different points, but your trajectory from here on out is up to you. And, you know, building those relationships with people, you can keep the ones with from the military or the professional athletes and those, but then who else? What other relationships do you want to have? And that's where that other identity development grows and things like that. And so, I mean, you're climbing mountains.
Yeah.
And things like that. You're a mountain climber.
Well, so. I'm a lot of things, right?
Yeah.
I have a work for Sports Illustrated and I do podcasts and public speak and do some other things. But, you know, I've always said and I can only speak, of course, from the athlete standpoint, but there's too many guys out there that focus on what happened 20 years ago. And I'm all about what's still ahead of me, right? And I think when you change that mindset, that focus, there's good things ahead of you, because that's what you're like, what can I do? What can I go after? And like you said, you know, you may go after something, it may not work out, and that's happened to me plenty, but you're going to know pretty quick.
Yeah.
And you're going to pivot, and you're going to go and try something different. Okay, so I know you've done a lot of things in between where we're going to go now, which is what you're doing now. You're the president and CEO of this organization called Project Recover. And I can't even begin to tell you how cool what you're doing is. I was about to tee it up, what you do, but since you're the president and CEO, you're probably a little bit better at like describing exactly what you guys do. But, you know, your mission, the amount of families you've touched by what you're about to say, I can only imagine has been absolutely incredible. So why don't you tee up and give us an idea of what Project Recover is all about?
Yeah, so Project Recover is a nonprofit organization, and we search for Americans missing in action from our previous wars. And that goes all the way back to World War II. Most people don't realize, but there's 82,000 Americans still missing in action. And when they hear POW, MIA, things like that. Most of the time they think of Vietnam, and that's realistic. But of those 82,000, 72,000 are from World War II, 7,000 are from the Vietnam or the Korean conflict, and then now less than 1,600 remain MIA from the Vietnam conflict. And so we have done mostly work in World War II era sites, but we've come all the way up to Desert Storm. So we gather information year-round, and we do search missions throughout the world based on the information and data that we gather. And we search for sites, we find sites, we identify those sites, who's associated with those sites. Traditionally, we've turned that information over to the Department of Defense. Their organization is called the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, DPAA. And then they have made a decision to do recovery on those sites that we've located. But now our mission is actually expanding into recovery in cooperation with DPAA. So we're doing everything from initial research, searching the waters and jungles all over the world for these people that are missing, and then locating those sites, identifying those sites, recovering those remains, repatriating those remains. And then the only thing that we're not going to be doing in that mission is the DNA analysis that happens in labs that the DOD controls.
A couple of questions. What does repatriate mean?
Yeah, so
I didn't understand.
Bring home.
Bring home.
Yeah,
okay,
bring
so
home.
You've, yep. you brought home 14 MIAs.
Yep.
And then the other bunch that mm-hmm. you've identified on the scene, but there's nothing to bring home. It's just like...
Well, we have open cases. So so far we found sites associated with about 170 missing Americans. Mm-hmm. 70 of them have been designated lost at sea because they're deep water sites associated with ships.
Okay.
And the Navy makes a decision those are not going to be disturbed, so we'll designate them lost at sea. We won't do a recovery. Navy tradition, not unusual. 14 repatriations have occurred. 14 have been returned to their families, and 87 cases are still open. So the recovery efforts have to still occur, or the identification has to be completed, things like that.
So give me an example of some, it's probably one of these 14 mm-hmm. examples of where, you know, you identified this person, you identify where they might be, you went and you got them, you recovered, brought them back and delivered to their loved ones.
Yeah. So believe it or not, this organization's been around in some capacity for 27 years.
Yep.
And started as a very, very grassroots organization. When I started with it, it was still very, very grassroots. We paid our own way. We did one mission a year to the nation of Palau. So we've worked in Palau quite a bit. And so we found multiple...
And where was Palau?
It's in the South Pacific. It's about 500 miles south of Guam and about 500 miles east of the Philippines.
Okay. Yeah.
Small island nation, about 20,000 people live there. A number of islands make up this area. There was an amphibious campaign that occurred on the island of Peleliu, which is part of Palau, and 9 major air campaigns. So even though most people don't really know where Palau is, there were the third most losses in the Pacific happened in Palau, right behind Okinawa and Iwo Jima, which most people know about.
Yeah, so this would have been a station where the Japanese might have been.
So the Japanese had a couple airfields there and about 50 to 60,000 troops based on those islands, and it was part of the island hopping campaign that occurred across the Pacific. So the Marines landed, we took one of the airfields, but then we just kept the rest of the Japanese in place until the end of the war. So cut off supply lines and used aviation assets to keep them in place, and we didn't have to invade the rest of the country for that island. But with those 9 major air campaigns and that amphibious assault, there were a number of people that were lost in and around Palau, and that was one of the reasons that we started doing all the work that we do there, and we still work there. And so we found the B-24 associated with 8 MIAs that were ultimately repatriated. Some Navy Avengers. So Navy Avengers have 3 people on them. So one of the pretty cool stories is one of those Avengers was piloted by a gentleman named Lieutenant Houle, and on his wing, -2, was a young ensign named George Herbert Walker Bush. Mm. And Lieutenant Houle, unfortunately, was shot down and lost and was missing for 70-plus years. And President Bush actually was very interested in what happened to Lieutenant Houle. He met some of our members early on, and we used to send him annual reports. Well, we found Lieutenant Houle's aircraft in 2015.
Now, how do you find his aircraft?
It's in the water, and that's part of the growing story of what is Project Recover. And so we used to do just regular scuba dive, get online, and we'd search the ocean floor doing that, which could take a million years to finish this work. But in 2012, we actually started working with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and University of Delaware. They were in Palau, we were in Palau, we met up with them, kind of said, what are you doing? Or like, what are you doing? We realized really quickly that there was this mutual benefit from working together. They're using automated underwater robots to map the ocean floor.
Wow.
And we could use those to take side scan and sonar imagery of the ocean floor. And then instead of scanning online in basic scuba, we could scan that information, pull out points of interest that look man-made or potential crash sites and things like that, dive those points, determine if they were the crash site or not, and then right back up and go on to the next point, next point, next point. And so that's how we did it. We scanned the lagoon floor around Palau in this area and found Lieutenant Houle's aircraft.
Wow.
And two of the crew were repatriated off of that aircraft. Lieutenant Houle remains missing. We believe he got off the airplane and was eventually captured by the Japanese. But one of those crew members was a gentleman named Walter Mittes, and he has since been repatriated back to his family in Portage, Pennsylvania. And so we found the site. We turned all that information over to the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. They took it. They assessed the information. They decided to do a recovery effort. They recovered the remains of two of the crew off of that, identified them, and then they made the announcement to the family that their loved one had been identified. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to the family on how they want to memorialize that person. They could have them buried in Arlington National Cemetery. They can bring them back to their hometown. The Mintus family decided to bring them back to his hometown in Portage, Pennsylvania. And it's just all of these memorials are absolutely incredible and indescribable, and the reason that we do the work that we do. On this one specifically, it was a cold November day. His remains were flowing into Pittsburgh, and an entourage of people drove them the couple hours from Pittsburgh to Portage. And as you arrived into town, the schools had let out the K-12 students, and the entire community were lining the streets, waving flags, hands over their hearts, welcoming him home after being missing for more than 70 years.
Incredible.
And you know, it's nonpartisan. There's nobody out there that really says, "There's, you know, why are you doing this? This isn't the right thing to do."
Yeah.
You know, when you put on the cloth of our nation and agree to serve in the military, our nation makes a promise to you that if you fall in battle, we'll do everything that we can to return you home to your loved ones. And the circumstances of war have prevented that from happening for about 82,000 people. But we're going to keep on doing it. That promise still remains, and we're going to keep that promise. And so that's what we do. We strive to keep America's promise. And one of the neat things about this is, you know, it is a memorial. It is a funeral. There's sadness about it, but it's also a celebration in many ways. So people like Walter Mintus and all the others that we've located and continue to search for, you know, they sacrificed, they made the ultimate sacrifice for our nation during these conflicts, and we benefit every day because of that. But when they're returned home, it's the second wave of impact from their loss 70 plus years later, where these communities unite, they come together, families reunited, stories or what were stories are now facts. They know the truth. MIA families have these incredible experiences where their grieving process is interrupted. And every single MIA family that we've interacted with, you know, they've made up stories about their loved ones, and they may or may not be accurate. Most of the time they're not accurate. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's caused friction within the family based on the stories that they've made up. And this allows that family to heal, and then the community around them to heal, and ultimately our nation to heal, because we're keeping a promise as a collective. So, you know, I say that people in our organization go through three different phases. When they come in, and that's my personal story as well, where it seems like the right thing to do. I want to do this. I want to play my part if I can play a part. And you join because of that or whatever your personal reasons are. And then you participate in a mission, and then you have your first discovery, and then it becomes real. So this person was missing. Now we found this person. This is real. Holy smokes. So that's another level of commitment. And then when you witness that person return to their families and the impact on these families that may not have ever met this person or they're generations removed, it's, you can't even put it into words. It's indescribable. And at that point, you're kind of hooked to the mission and fully committed. You know, that's my personal story. Definitely, this is something I'm going to continue to do.
No, it's incredible. I mean, you said this early in the podcast, is about your life's mission is really to impact people as much as you can. And this is a small little dose of, because it's a ripple effect, right? Mm-hmm. It's the mom who maybe got remarried. There's kids, there's their grandkids, mm-hmm. you know, it just goes all the way down the tree. And you always, you know, wonder what actually happened. I want to shift just a bit because there's a natural tie with Higher Ground. Mm-hmm. So Higher Ground is a fantastic organization that approached me this last year after I had thrown this event at Millions Everest. Now we're doing Millions Everest, the Losi Challenge. And I didn't know anything about Higher Ground. And, you know, mainly it's about helping former military people that have had cognitive issues, amputees, things like that. But rather than just give money and try to find, you know, a cause for PTSD, they're actually bringing them into these communities like Sun Valley. I know there's an office based out of LA and also New York. And the thing I like about it, and I've actually done this with Nate Boyer and Chris Long through their organization, Water Boys, by raising money and then not only building water wells down in Africa, but actually going into those villages in the Serengeti for the people of the Maasai tribe and really seeing like these people, you know, like we're the Beatles, you know, we've come in, you know, they're so grateful. They're so thankful. And there's such a change agent that's goes down in their life. And so for you, tell me what the connection, I mean, first of all, you're a former, obviously a military. So anybody in the military is, you know, you're in the club, but what is the connection, if any, between Project Recover and Higher Ground?
Both serving the military in some capacity. The majority of our members are active duty, former military or first responders. Not a requirement, but that's just tends to be a lot of the people that we attract.
Yeah.
And we're committed to the military population, in our case, Gold Star families that have made the ultimate sacrifice. And so they do the same thing. They're patriots that have a commitment to the military population. They realize the impact that they can have. You know, it started right here in Sun Valley, and then kind of grew from that. And they're investing in that. So, you know, kind of going back to where does your voice carry weight? Mine turned somehow has happened. It's turned into this MIAPOW community and military community, and they made that assessment themselves with the military community. And so we paralleled on those lines, and then through mutual relationships, quality relationships, we became connected. And then I came out here to kind of visit with them and look at what they're doing, seeing how we can support each other. Yep. If there's ways of collaborating and things like that.
Well, of course there is. And you never know until you, again, action creates reaction, and you have crossed that line. And just like I did, and I was so impressed and blown away by the number of people here in Sun Valley that are there to hold their hands out and how can we help? Mm-hmm. And right now, my daughter has epilepsy. And so, again, if you go back to my site, markpattisonnfl.com, there's a tab. And on there, on the philanthropic part of that is Amelia's Everest. And, of course, all the money goes to Higher Ground. It doesn't go to me for my clients. It doesn't go to Amelia for her epilepsy. But, you know, when you put all the power and the strength behind that, it goes towards solving these big problems. And at the end of the day, it's about helping people, right? And that's what you're doing. You're doing that with Project Recover. I'm trying to do that with my little bitty part, you know, in the Millions Everest, the Losi Challenge, by physically doing something, taking on that to hopefully inspire others to give to this cause for all these wonderful people that have been impacted in some way. And we're trying to get them on the right track towards on their healing. I've seen what it's done with my daughter. So, I mean, you're doing all the right things. And, you know, I'll go back and say for the third time, actually the second time, we're bringing it up for the third time, what you said about making impact on people. Mm-hmm. And because you're trying to really, you know, you're looking ahead out in the future. You're not hanging all your stripes on what you did, you know, years ago in the military. And that is what makes this conversation to me and anybody that's listening so impactful. You know, get out there, make a difference and get involved, man, because you do make a difference in people's lives.
I mean, it's not actually that difficult. It doesn't need to be on the same scale of literally climbing Everest or traveling around the world looking for people that are missing in jungles and oceans. It's in your community. It's across the street. It's the small things that you can do every day to help your neighbors. And, you know, and it could be just having a friendly conversation. Like I said, examine your own sphere and where does your voice carry weight and where can you have an impact and can you grow that? But if it's small, start small and then just try to continue to grow it as much as you can. Over time in a positive way. And I mean, when you're talking about thinking, looking towards the future and not focusing on the past, that's, I mean, the way that I describe positive psychology is very more future focused, and traditional psychology looks at what is it that you're suffering from that occurred in the past. So let's, you know, we need to look at that stuff sometimes so we can move forward in a better way. But if we focus on the positive impact that we can have in the future, you're going to follow that. And you might adjust, you might change a little bit, that course might you know, shift a little bit, you might fail or trip up a little, but that's when you're going to learn and figure out, you know, how to do it better the next time. And it's okay.
I love that word that you just use, shift, because it's a powerful word and it helps form everything that you want to do. And your mindset is everything, and where your focus goes, your energy always follows, man. And if you all of a sudden you've got this, you know, again, you said it perfectly. It doesn't have to be Mount Everest, but I would challenge anybody. I'd say to anybody listening to this, what's your Everest, right? That has nothing to do with Mount Everest. It's just, what's your Everest? What's going to stretch you? What's going to make you go out there? And you'll wake up the next morning, and rather than poor me and why isn't it, you know, that goes away. It's just like you're energized and you're jacked up because you have a goal that you have to get up and go get.
And then it's part of living a healthy lifestyle too. You know, when you look at yourself as the person, like making yourself the best instrument, you know, you're climbing these mountains, and I pick out ways of challenging myself on a regular basis. I'm trying to run a marathon, at least a marathon in every state an ultra counts. So Idaho, actually, I ran an ultra, the Beaverhead ultra marathon up here. And, but also just spending time outdoors. And sometimes people are like, you know, it's uncomfortable. And to me, that's okay, because you know, the difficulty allows you to learn a little bit more about yourself. At minimum, you know you're alive. You know you're alive so you can keep on having an impact on people. And, you know, I look at my past and people that I did serve with that don't have the opportunity to have the impact that I can have, or these people that I'm searching for that gave up the best years of their life so that we can have an impact. And so I feel like I owe it to these people and our community to be the very, very best version of myself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the physical challenges are important. Challenging yourself in some way, and that could be education, you know, reading books. It could be getting out and climbing mountains. And I climb some mountains, but I haven't been above. The highest one I've done is Whitney. So I guess I'm maxed out right now at 14.5. About half of what you're doing.
You know what? Second highest mountain in North America. Yeah. It's pretty good. So love it, love it, love it. Okay, so where can people find you? And I want them to go to this really cool site, Project Recover.
Yeah, it's very easy. Projectrecover.org.
Yep.
And then we're on all the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. And so am I, Derek Abbey. If you search Project Recovery on any of those sites, you'll find us, and same thing with me.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love it. Listen, it's been a great conversation to talk to a guy all the way from DQ to the one, the only, Derek Abbey, PhD. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
All right, buddy. Take care. Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, Until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids' bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season. And inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at guardianbikes.com. That's guardianbikes.com.